This podcast is an unedited excerpt from an MCLE program presented at MCLE's Conference Center in Boston, Massachusetts. Get 24/7 instant access to over 150 practice development e-lectures and more with a subscription to the MCLE Online Pass. Learn more at www.mcle.org/onlinepass.
So I'm going to hand it over to Ed. Ed will speak on some ethical considerations with succession planning.
Hi. So my concern is, or what I'll be talking about, is more from an ethical standpoint. And the golden rule, which Jeremy touched on at the beginning, is the BBO really looks at things from the client standpoint, right? So naturally, from your perspective, you're thinking, how am I going to transition? How am I going to maintain the client base? How am I going to monetize my goodwill, and so on? But in doing these things, the BBO looks at the steps that you take from the client from the client's perspective, and they're thinking about, you maintain the client's choice of counsel. Are the fees still reasonable and fair? And do you make sure that the clients know what's going on? So that's the sort of golden rule that you just need to keep thinking about in your succession planning. So I'm just going to hit on a couple rules, and then I'll talk about Meehan v. Shaughnessy, which has to do with leaving firms. So IALTA, your IALTA account, that's a good place for people to get tripped up on Rule 1.15. Watch out when you're switching banks. I mean, you're going to have your IALTA account, and if you want to transition to another firm, you know, you want to move money from one bank to another bank. So I had a client who wasn't leaving his firm, but all he was doing was switching banks. That was all he was doing. And his software failed to account for the fact that there were still outstanding checks from the first bank when they moved accounts to the second bank. And so there were a couple checks that came in and bounced, and he immediately fixed it, but boom, the bank reported the issue to bar counsel. And we're going to fix it, but you know, it's better to have avoided that rather than have to fix it by talking to bar counsel. So just, you know, you're winding down your practice, or you're transitioning your practice, or you're moving your practice, so your IALTA account's going to be moved. Another thing is, you know, it's tempting. I actually had a client do this. He parked some of his retirement funds in the IALTA account. I know. It's
I'm instantly cringing. Sorry.
Yeah. And his reasoning, and he gave me this wonderful, elaborate reasoning. He said, well, you know, I'm just a person. When the money comes to me in my retirement, or it's for tax purposes, you know, they had a couple things put in there. And so I could just put it in the IALTA because we kept it in a separate account. And then I pointed out to him, the word account may not mean what you think it means, because it's all the same account in the bank, and you have just commingled funds like there's no tomorrow. So don't park any of your funds, retirement funds, tax payments, anything in your IALTA account. IALTA account's just for your clients.
With the one little extra caveat, you could have like a nominal amount of your own funds if you're having to, say, have wire fees, check fees. Not every bank will give you free checks with an IALTA account. Right. So, but nominal.
Right.
So.
which is make sure there's enough to cover bank fees. Right?
Exactly.
That's important. And what bar counsel seems to be giving clients a little bit of a hard time with lately is, if you've got a large amount in your IALTA account for a particular client, let's say 100,000, quarter of a million, and you know, you're just thinking about, how am I going to be doing the succession, and you just leave it in your IALTA, which is a non-interest bearing, well, actually it bears interest, but it goes to the IALTA committee. Bar counsel is starting to frown on that, so you need to move it into an interest-bearing account in the client's name, right? So I was a little surprised to even have to argue this particular issue with bar counsel, but these are from real clients, real cases that I'm handling that are live today, all right? So just keep that in mind for the IALTA. All right, that's probably enough. Oh, Rule 1.6, confidentiality of client information. I touched a little bit about it. So comment 13 says you can disclose client information only after there's been substantive discussions, after substantive discussions have occurred. Okay. That's wonderfully vague. Okay. But that means you have to have like a real plan or a real thoughts about either, you know, some sort of a succession or sale of your practice or merger or something like that before you start exchanging information for conflicts checks, all right? So there is a safe harbor for the conflicts checks that's been mentioned, which is you can definitely disclose the identity of the people involved, a very brief summary of the issues. You have to be very careful not to disclose attorney-client communications, privileged information, okay? Now, as I had alluded to before, the mere disclosure of your client's name could also be the disclosure of confident client information. So even though there's nominally this safe harbor, the rules giveth and taketh back, right? They say you can't disclose client information, but you can disclose names for conflicts checks, but you can't do it if you're going to reveal attorney-client privilege communications. Right? So they keep dumping it back into your lap to make sure that you're protecting your clients. For some people, it's more important than others, right? So if you are, I'm not trivializing, but let's say you're a personal injury lawyer, the fact that you have such a person who's been injured is your client is not a state secret. But again, if you're a divorce attorney, if you're an M&A attorney, you know, if you have information, or if the fact that a person or an entity is your client in itself is sensitive, be very, very careful and give it a lot of thought. Or better yet, talk to an impartial person who can help walk you through the decision. Because it's remarkable how much the fact that a person's income can affect your decisions in terms of client confidentiality. That's just an impartial observation. This becomes even more of a problem when you're trying to value your practice, right? Because as Jeremy was talking about, how do you value your goodwill? Well, you value the goodwill by the book of business. And how do you know what the book of business is? Well, you have to talk about who the clients are, the nature of the cases, the likelihood of success, right? That's per se work product, right? What are the circumstances? How do you evaluate the witnesses? How do you evaluate, you know, what the ultimate outcome is going to be? That's all attorney-client work product. That's attorney work product and privileged communications, and you can only disclose that with client permission. Okay, so the safe harbor only goes to the client's name and a very, very bare summary of the case. Once you start talking a little bit more in depth, particularly in light of valuing goodwill, then you have to get the client's permission, right? And it goes back to the golden rule. They're worried, the BBO is worried more about protecting the client, their information, than they are about you, okay? All right. Meehan v. Shaughnessy, it's a great case for everybody other than the attorneys involved, because it gives you a couple roadmaps. Meehan v. Shaughnessy is a case where there was a firm, Paul Parker Coulter, and a couple of the very, very successful attorneys there were going to leave. And, you know, you can kind of think about, so what happened is the partners, they talked about, the departing partners talked about, hey, who are our clients going to be? Who are we going to take with us in terms of attorneys? When are we going to disclose this to our partners, and how are we going to make sure that the clients we want are going to go with us, right? And so, you know, they talked to each other, they had little chats with their clients. Hey, you know, hypothetically, if we're going to leave, who do you like better, you know, me or Bob? You know, I have this neat tie, please come with us, right? And so by the time they actually told the firm, we're going to be leaving, the ground had already been laid for a lot of these clients to leave. Surprise, surprise. But, you know, all kidding aside, course you want to do this stuff, right? Because if you're in a firm, if you've got partners, and you're thinking about leaving, you know, your value is in large part what is the book you're going to bring with you. And you need to know what the book is that you're going to bring with you. But the problem is, it's not really a problem, but the thing is you have a fiduciary duty to your partners. You know, when you're in a partnership, and whether it's a small partnership, a big partnership, you know, you have a duty of loyalty, of candor to your partners, right? So, for example, if a partner asks you, hey, you know, you've been talking a lot behind closed doors. Are you thinking of leaving? You can't lie to that partner. And the SJC specifically said that. You have to be truthful to your partners, right? And, in fact, that ended up accelerating the timetable for the partners to leave in this case. Employees, associates, also owe a duty of loyalty to the firm. So they can't engage in conduct, you know. So when you're still with the firm, you're still with the firm. You cannot take steps to push revenues, to push cases, till the day after you depart the firm, because then you're not acting in furtherance of the firm, right? Remember, you're still a partner of the firm. You owe a duty of care to the firm. And what they found in this case was that the partners acted appropriately. They settled the cases, you know, according to the timetable that was organic to the case. You know, they prosecuted and pushed the cases along as they were supposed to, and so that was fine. But you need to take that into account. So you can't manipulate cases to the detriment of the firm. Now, you can make arrangements for departure that don't affect clients and the health of the firm. So, you know, you can line up insurance. You can line up an office, create your own LLC, you know, start gathering employees and you know, go get your copy machine, things like that. You can do that. You should do that. But again, you just can't do things that are to the detriment of the firm because you're still a partner at the firm. All right, so if you're going to leave a firm and you have partners, if you're not a solo, read me and V. Shaughnessy before you do anything, or there are a number of articles out there that kind of walk you through the things that you can and can't do. Okay. A really important part of me and V. Shaughnessy is then it gives you a roadmap of what you can do when you're going to depart. And the main thing is you need to send, before you start lobbying your clients, you need to send an impartial letter to all the clients that you're thinking of taking and that you've been working with. Okay, and the impartial letter, I've drafted it before, basically says something like, you know, Edward Cheng is going to be leaving Sharon and Lodgen. You know, you have your choice of attorneys, so it must be impartial. You can't say, Ed Cheng, the scumbag Darth Vader's son, is leaving the firm. You know, do not join the dark side. Stay with the good people. Right? That would be frowned upon. You need to give a reasonable notice. You mail it to the clients. You know, I'm pretty sure you can use email today, but you know, back at the time of the decision, they said mail it. And then it's almost literally a race to the phones, and you can start calling the clients and say, hey, you know, I'm better looking, I'm smarter, I use better cologne, stay with me, okay? You laugh, but, you know, these things happen, okay? Yeah, but it was really funny. Well, all right, I'll just leave it at that. So that's really, you know, that's the main thing that you have to do when you're leaving the firm, right? And so, you know, it's, to the extent that we're talking about some of the downsides of the 1.117, you know, disclosure requirement, I mean, you kind of have to do it under me and V. Boyle anyway when you're leaving a firm with partners, and it has to be an impartial letter, and it has to give them the option, right? The SJC is protecting the client's choice of lawyers, so that's the important part. You join a new law firm. And there are all kinds of business parts. You know, you want to protect your income stream from the matters you bring in. But So you're saying, okay, I'm going to join this great firm, and they have this amazing associate or amazing young partner, and I'm going to work with this person. I'm so happy because they can slowly take my book, and over the period of the next 5 years, I'm going to groom this person. And, you know, as my work ramps down, this person ramps up. And according to the fee-sharing agreement and the partnership agreement, I'm going to sit back in Cancun, and the money is just, they're just going to write me a check once a month, and this is going to be awesome, right? Which it is until that partner leaves the firm, right? That's one of the things you need to think about. Because what you cannot do under the rules is you cannot restrict. There are two things you can't do. You can't restrict clients' choice of counsel, right? So if this young hotshot partner is leaving the firm, you cannot keep the clients from leaving with that hotshot young attorney, right? And the second thing is you can't keep that hotshot young attorney from leaving the firm, right? Because that comes part and parcel of clients always get to choose their attorneys. And so you need to think about how you're going to handle that situation. The other case of course, I'm blanking on the name. I was going to say, you know, you can stick with.
If I may, I think you're thinking of Eisenstein. It's Eisenstein and Conlin is an SJC case from 2005 that speaks to exactly what Ed's talking about, and it raises a lot of practical issues from exactly what the point that Ed is making. That is, if an attorney is joining a firm and is, you know, quote unquote, grooming or working with younger attorneys with the expectation that the benefit of the bargain is to be realizing fee sharing on the clients attributable to the senior attorney, and that younger attorney then leaves the firm, the question is, does that younger attorney have a duty to fulfill the retirement agreement with the firm or the agreement with the firm that the senior attorney is at? And the Eisenstein case follows exactly what Ed is talking about. It's client decision. And the argument that the departing attorney made, again, leave it to smart attorneys to come up with fascinating arguments, was that if the departing attorney needed to pay back essentially 15 cents on the dollar, it was essentially a 15% deal, then that attorney could no longer afford to represent the client that wants to hire the attorney that departed the firm. And the SJC equated that 15% fee sharing as a restrictive covenant, and said that the lawyer who departed with the clients can continue representing the clients at that lawyer's current hourly rate without needing to pay the senior attorney at the firm, or really in that case it was the firm itself, from which the departing attorney, I don't know if took is too strong of a word, but departed with the clients.
Right, and that goes back to, you know, concepts of you can't increase fees to clients, and if there are any sort of fee-sharing agreements, you have to have the client's approval after the departure of the attorney and client. You want to think about things like, well, do you want to try to participate in future revenue streaming when they leave, or do you want to do some sort of there was a fair charge upfront fee that was paid in the Meehan case, where the partners departing could not be kept from taking clients, but they paid a certain amount to the firm, you know, for every client in case they took. So that just keeps from having to have the client consent to any fee sharing agreements going forward, if that makes sense. So those are the main points that I have.